Welcome to the Capitol Press Room. I'm Susan Arbetter. Wednesday was a big day in Albany. After almost 30 years, the legislature held hearings on sexual harassment. We spoke with the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Liz Krueger, about the hearings and what she thinks is the end game. Last week's decision by Amazon to scrap their plans for an H2Q in Long Island City sent a shockwave through the New York political sphere. Dr. Jeannie Zeno, professor of political science at Iona, and Dr. Doug Muzio, professor of political science at Baruch, will share their analysis. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan joined us on Monday about the city's perennial $12.5 million budget gap and what she hopes to hear from Governor Cuomo this year. And critics of cannabis legislation are gaining some traction. We spoke with the executive director of the New York State PTA about her concerns. It's all coming up on the Capitol Press Room. Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger has just finished presiding over a month-long marathon of legislative budget hearings on issues like education, health care, and economic development. Today, she's present for one more hearing, and this one is on sexual harassment, an issue that hasn't been aired out in Albany in almost three decades and is long overdue. Senator Liz Krueger joins us today to talk about the issue and why it's so critical. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
You don't seem the worse for wear after three some weeks of legislative hearings.
I think I have a little pallor to the skin.
You haven't seen the sun. Liz Krueger.
A long time.
Not enough D vitamin.
Exactly.
So on sexual harassment, this is an important day. Why did it take so long for Albany to get on board with Me Too?
I suppose you could ask the question, why did America take so long to get on board with Me Too?
And Albany even longer.
And Albany even longer. Now, Albany thinks it addressed this issue last year when there's a when the governor put a bill on the table and it was passed. But we didn't deal with it. It was a half a loaf, and some employment law experts have actually pointed out they think parts of it actually make it harder for people to get justice. So I think we took one bite at the apple. It wasn't the right bite, and now we need to go back and really pass the kind of laws and policies that will ensure that wherever you work, whether it's the private sector, whether you're a government employee in an agency, or whether you're a government employee working for an elected official, because there are different rules,
yes,
that you have equal rights to bring a complaint forward, not to your boss, but to someone independent who has the power to follow through, investigate, and do what needs to get done.
And who has the political clout.
Correct.
Yeah. That's so critical here,
yes,
in a place where power is the currency.
Exactly.
Hearing from people who have been subjected to abuse is important. And that's what's going to happen today. What are you going to be listening for?
Well, I've actually, I think, had the privilege to get to know the members of these sexual harassment working group fairly well over the course of the last year, year and a half. We've had many meetings, many discussions about their analysis of what works and doesn't work. I have met with employment law specialists who deal with harassment cases, more likely in the private sector, but some in the public sector. I have reviewed materials that explain why what we did weren't right. I think that the sexual harassment task force members want people to focus on what the fixes are. To some degree, people know their stories now. They have been brave and articulate and, frankly, worked with the press very effectively to get their stories out. And I think what they are saying is, okay, you've heard us. You're going to hear from some additional people, but what we need you to do is go back and fix the laws.
One of the issues that is sort of tangential, but I think really sticks in the craw of members of the group is that
abusers, people like Michael Boxley, who have been censured or found guilty of sexual misconduct, are allowed to simply strut on over to lobbying firms across the street and use the contacts that they made here at the state capitol to get a job. Is that something you'll be addressing?
I hope that that will actually be a proposal. It's always a tricky question because if the person wasn't found guilty of anything, then how do you say you're applying a new law to people like them? Because you are innocent until proved guilty, and we do believe in that. Yes. I believe in that. I think everybody working on this issue believes in that. But the fact is, what happened with Michael Boxley in two different situations should never have been allowed to have the outcomes that they did.
He was an aide to Sheldon Silver, who raped Elizabeth Crothers, who we'll be hearing from today, I think.
Yes, and then he was accused of a second incident, and that's when he finally got fired. And I believe, you know, I think he did plead to some...
Oh, he did. He pleaded guilty to sexual assault.
And he had his, I think, law license taken for some period of time. So perhaps in that situation, one could put a no on his being able to come back and lobby the legislature, because he actually did plead guilty to charges here in the Capitol. And by the way, it's exceptionally important because it's not just people who would move on and still maximize their advantages from having worked here. I've also had people who would not come forward, I don't think they'll come forward today, but who have been lobbyists who faced sexual harassment in the office of legislators when they were lobbying them. But they feel that they will ruin their career forever if they come forward, and so they don't. So, you know, it's fundamentally the need to change the culture. Because you just, you know, it's like some people say, we've got to raise our kids to understand what's not okay, because there is, it seems, as we're learning from press accounts through the Me Too movement, it's like it's everywhere. Yeah. It's ubiquitous. And everybody was keeping their mouth shut for so long that we need to make our laws stronger, but we need to change our culture so that people don't think it's okay to do it, or you can't come forward and stop them when they are doing it.
Yeah, that feeling of hopelessness needs to be eliminated. So Jeff Kline was accused of forcibly kissing Erica Vladimir. She is going to be testifying today. Kline did ask Jacob to investigate. Where is that right now?
Excellent question. I don't think they've ever said they closed the case. I'm not sure they ever said they opened the case.
Did contact Erica.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess they did then somehow open the case, but I'm quite sure we've never heard whether or not they closed the case. But Jacob, that's one of the many problems of Jacob. They never have to tell you anything. They never have to tell. If you've been accused, they never have to tell you anything. If you're the person bringing the complaint, they never have to say anything. I have a constitutional amendment that would completely redraw the entity we now know as JCOB.
How so?
Making it independent. So right now the governor and the legislature choose who's on it, and the people on it get to decide whether they're not taking up a case based on who appointed them to JCOB. That's crazy.
So the Prococo issue is reflective of that sort of ridiculousness.
So we need an independent entity with real teeth, a broader mandate of what they can look at. They can only look at the public officer's law. There's nothing in the public officer's law about sexual harassment. There's one sentence in the entire bill that references inappropriate use of your resources as a senator or an assembly member, or the governor. It's like, no, that's not the definition of harassment in the workplace. So they don't even have the tools to use if they chose to use them. And right now, they're not choosing to use them.
So separate from your constitutional amendment to, you know, reconfigure JCOB, is that the right entity for dealing with sexual harassment?
I think it could be the right entity. It doesn't mean it has to be the exclusive only entity. The Human Rights Commission in the city of New York actually has more teeth than our Human Rights Commission here, and they actually can do investigations and penalize people. GOER, the
Government's Office of Employee Relations.
So I questioned them during the hearing about their new policies, because I remember last year at some point
the governor
were told,
had wanted to
go to GOER, and yeah. GOER was, you don't come to us, what do we know about it? So now there's a new policy where everybody who's a state employee, not for the legislature or the executive branch, but all the other agencies, they're supposed to go to GOER. And in fairness, the commissioner laid out a pretty solid new system for bringing a complaint. We didn't get to what he's doing about them when he gets them. But I think that's actually an important question yeah. for today as well.
Yeah. So GOER will be testifying?
So many agencies are testifying. I'm not sure.
JACOB will be testifying.
JACOB's testifying. Labor's, Human Rights. I think there were five government agencies testifying.
All right. So at this point, though, if you are employed by a lawmaker here at the state capitol, your only avenue for justice is to go to JACOB?
I think so. There's still a little bit of debate. Some people say, no, you should have the same rights as other state agency employees, but it's voluntary by the executive and the legislature to follow that rule. Well, it can't be voluntary.
Yeah, that's troublesome.
That's not okay.
Yeah.
So I do think, and it's the dilemma, because people who are appointed by an elected, they serve, quote unquote, at the pleasure of the elected.
Which is another way of saying at the whim.
Correct. And so these people actually have the fewest employment rights of any worker in New York State. And that translates strangely when it comes to sexual harassment and other issues.
So, as you know, the members of the sexual harassment working group say they want these hearings to be the beginning and not the end. So what is the end game?
I think it was probably translate into multiple pieces of legislation that move through both houses. I know that Alexandra Biaggi, our new senator who runs the Ethics Committee, she actually asked for a change of language of what the Ethics Committee's role was, so that she could take on these issues and introduce legislation through the committee. That was never part of the role of the committee in the past. So I think perhaps an interview with her after today's hearing might be a great idea.
Senator Liz Krueger, she's the chair of the Senate Finance Committee and occasionally a radio producer. I want to thank you very much for joining me. She's going to be sitting in on the sexual harassment hearings today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
So the governor's office has sprayed a fire hose of blame on a variety of people, mostly Senate Democrats, for the failed Amazon deal. Not just Senator Mike Gianaris, the most vocal critic of the deal, but also on his boss, new Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, and on one of the newer members of her conference, Long Island's Todd Kominsky, who a Cuomo spokesperson said should have fought for Long Island's interests. Today, we're going to hear from a couple of political scientists about what this might mean for New York State, the governor, and the state budget. First up, Baruch College's Doug Muzio, co-director of the Center for the Study of Innovation and Leadership in Government. Thank you so much for joining me. You have said that you have contradictory thoughts about Amazon. What do you mean?
I do, on so many levels. What motivated Amazon to fail that fast? What was it about their corporate decision making that led them to pull out? They haven't, announced a new second headquarters. They just said they're going to keep the status quo. So something happened there. Now, as far as the governor is concerned, I think the governor It's an example of the governor's arrogance. I would argue that the governor, in a sense, blew it. He assumed that he saw it. It was good. Therefore, it was good for the state, and ignored local constituencies. And I think that sort of he and de Blasio got together and said, well, we never agree with anything, and if we agree on that, everybody will fall into line.
It must be good if the two of us agree. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. Now, the thing about this deal is that it was very different from the other big deal that Cuomo brokered, which is the Buffalo Billion deal.
Yep.
This one, a lot of economic development experts says, was done much better. And it was through, you know, it's really a deal that had a lot of accountability in it. What it didn't have was transparency. And that's a problem.
Yep. I mean, it is absolutely the problem. The fact that they didn't really consult with local officials, knowing they should have consultants telling them, if they didn't realize it, that New York City is very contentious, particularly over land use.
Right.
So they should have been prepared. They should have met with local legislators, heard them out, modified plans to their demands. None of that. And on top of it, that they made it a mantra that they weren't union in a union city. I mean, they made either mistakes or it's somehow conscious.
So will this scare tech from coming to New York City or even to New York State? Are we too activist in some way?
It's a policy question. No, I don't think so. I think that we should examine thoroughly the implications of giving away tax incentives of $3 billion. Is it worth it in terms of simple cost benefit analysis? Is the corporate structure amenable to the values of the city of New York? There are a whole stream of questions.
Berea College's Doug Muzio, co-director of the Center for the Study of Innovation and Leadership in Government. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now we're going to turn to Iona College professor of political science, Jeannie Zeno. So Doug Muzio just said Cuomo blew it. What do you think?
You know, the way I have described it is I think both Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio were caught flat-footed. There's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of factors to consider on both sides. But I do think they were caught flat-footed. And, you know, I'm not sure that they or Amazon did the due diligence they needed to do on the ground to get this thing done.
So there seems to be a strange disconnect between the governor's rhetoric around unions and his disappointment over Amazon, which has clearly shown an anti-union bias. What do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Amazon has shown this bias, and it is, you know, the governor's rhetoric, as you mentioned, doesn't seem, again, to be in concert with where you would expect the governor to be at this point. And so it's hard for me to know if this is, you know, the advice the governor is getting or if this is, you know, really where he is. But it does seem clearly to be a disconnect with where the Democratic Party is. And that's something that the governor usually is very attuned to. And so it's surprising from that perspective.
So I think that there's a sense, frankly, that this situation reflects the greater rift in the National Democratic Party, what some describe as like the progressives versus the corporate Democrats, the Ocasio-Cortezes versus the Joe Crowleys. What do you think? Is that an accurate description?
I do think that is an accurate description. I do think you do see a divide in the Democratic Party. We've seen it in New York for a long time. The governor has lived it in two primary challenges from the left at this point. He knows it full well. But I also think this reflects larger forces, including our view of our being Americans' views of these big tech companies.
Yeah.
Let's not forget when Amazon started this beauty contest, and really I've described it as like they were looking, you know, like a Bachelor contestant. It was a bizarre thing to do this contest. It was 2017. You flash forward to 2019. Our views of big tech companies have changed a lot, as has the appetite to regulate those companies. So I think in both in concert with the changes in the Democratic Party and our views of big tech companies, I think this was sort of a force that was moving in a direction that both the governor and the mayor were caught off guard. And quite frankly, I think Amazon itself, and I do think both the governor and the mayor should be frustrated by how the company handled even the pullout itself.
Yeah.
They were talking
to city and state officials up until the very last minute, apparently till after they made the decision.
We understand that neither the governor or the mayor was able to get in touch with Bezos. I think just the very idea that Amazon tried to do this and didn't have New Yorkers on the ground here working on behalf of the company. In other words, all of these people were coming in from the outside.
Right.
It stunned me to hear that because it's bad business. It's bad politics. And I think it sort of shows an arrogance that people, I think, are viscerally responding to on the part of the company.
Do you think, I think that I agree with you. And I'm wondering if you think bad PR is going to stick to that company, because it sort of seems like they picked up their ball and stormed away without any attempt to negotiate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's going to stick to them. I think, you know, they come to this with a real arrogance. We're going to hold a beauty contest. You all try to get in. And, you know, you have Governor Cuomo. I'll be Amazon Cuomo if they need me to. You know, this is not the way you do business. And so I do think this is going to stick with Amazon. I think it's already begun to stick with a lot of these big tech companies. And let's face it, why are they looking to move? They're looking to move because they've had real contentious problems with Seattle, and they have had real challenges out there. So, and I obviously they weren't moving from Seattle, but opening the second headquarters, if you will. So, you know, they've had challenges there. I think they didn't feel comfortable coming to a place where they weren't completely welcome. And I think, quite frankly, they mistakenly thought that New York, which is the tech hub of the world now, you know, was just going to open its doors and come on in. And I think, had they never experienced New York City and New York State politics, you know, I mean, it's to me, you know, they should have talked to somebody who knows the place to see what they were getting into. They could have negotiated this far better.
So what does this bode for the state budget? I mean, Cuomo has to deal with the Senate Democrats, and he has been peppering them with blame over this failed deal. We have about 30 seconds.
That surprises me. You know, in defense of the governor, you fight hard for 10 jobs in the state. You lose 25,000. He's got to be frustrated. But I don't see the blame for the Senate Democrats working to his favor. I think he's going to have, you know, surely he's frustrated. I think he's going to have to move forward and try to work with Senate Democrats. Andrea Stewart-Cousins, you know, she has a big caucus to manage. I think they can work together, but he's got to stop with the blame game. It's much bigger than the Senate Democrats.
Jeannie Zeno, political science professor at Iona. Thank you again.
Good to talk to you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO. 2.5 million members speaking with one voice to ensure a better life for working men and women. Information at nysaflcio.org.
You know, it's not a great time to be the mayor of a city facing a $12.5 million budget gap the week after the governor announces a $2.3 billion shortfall in tax receipts. But that is the position that Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan finds herself in today, and she joins us to talk about it. Welcome. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
So what went through your mind last Monday when the governor and the controller came out and said, we have less money than we thought?
You know, the issue in Albany is not about a budget gap. The issue in Albany is about a structural deficit driven by the injustice that exists in how the city of Albany is treated. And so notwithstanding the challenges with respect to revenue, which are going to happen every year, we seem to have things that come up that are unexpected, but every other city knows that they're going to get their AIM money, and they know what that amount is going to be, and the city of Albany is treated like none other. And
it's interesting you should say that every other city knows it's going to get its AIM money, because this year, Mayor, as you well know, 90% of villages and towns aren't getting any AIM money.
But the cities are all getting their AIM money.
Yes, they
and I
are.
Think when you look at the city of Albany, and any way you measure it, we have the same challenges, the same issues that exist for cities across this state with respect to our poverty rate, with respect to our homeownership rate, which is the lowest among the big cities outside of New York City, whether you're looking at it from the standpoint of taxable property, however you look at it. There is absolutely no excuse for the residents and people who live in some of the poorest census tracts to be the ones who are supporting state government across the state.
All right, let's back up. Every year, the mayor of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, who's my guest today, comes in here and talks about this $12.5 million budget gap. And once again, Kathy Sheehan, the governor, has not included that money in his executive budget, which would indicate that he doesn't see it as a problem of the same level that you do.
Well, here's the thing. Every year I come in and I ask for the same amount of money. That, by definition, is a structural deficit. I don't come here asking for more money just because my personnel costs have gone up because I've settled a contract with our firefighters or with the CSEA.
Which I'm sure that it has.
I don't come and ask for more money because our health insurance costs have gone up. I told the governor when I became mayor that we had a structural deficit driven by the injustice of how the city of Albany is treated, and that I could manage to the rest. And we've demonstrated our ability to manage to the rest. The time is now to fix this so that it's not on the table. This is not something that should be part of the negotiating table. This is something that needs to be fixed because the injustice is so clear.
So explain to my listeners in Buffalo, in Syracuse, in Binghamton, why you feel this is unjust.
Let's look at just per capita, right? So if you take unrestricted aid and you divide it by the number of people who live in your city, the city of Albany gets $128 of unrestricted aid per capita. If you are sitting in Buffalo, you should know that your city gets $623 per capita for each resident.
Is that unrestricted aid just for the city? Does that include education money?
It's unrestricted aid for the city. So here's the other thing, right? So let's break it down by all of the aid that you get. And let's look at our tax levies and what this injustice has driven. In the city of Albany, our city tax levy and our school tax levy combined is higher than the city of Buffalo. Not per capita, in dollars. Our total levy of school and city is $174 million. Buffalo is $145 million. That's how much more aid they get. So that their levy is actually lower than the city of Albany.
All right, now they are a larger city.
And their taxes are lower. Their tax levy is lower.
And people would say that they are a poorer city.
Well, let's look at it based on the number of poor people. So if you just take AIM, if you look at the poverty levels in this city, the poverty level in Buffalo is 31%. The poverty level in Albany is 24.5%. So let's just take that population. AIM per person living in poverty in Buffalo is $2,018. In Albany, it's $523. So a poor person in Buffalo is worth four times what a poor person in Albany is worth.
Or is more needy.
It's not more needy. I mean, if you're living below the poverty level, you're living below the poverty level. It's the same for all of our cities. And so, you know, any way you look at this, the city of Albany, in addition to all of that, is the home of state government. The state of New York owns more property in value in the city of Albany than all of our taxpayers combined. And our taxpayers are paying to support the infrastructure that's needed for the people who come in here to work every day.
The roads, the bridges, the water infrastructure, the fact that you can flush a toilet at the state offices is because you guys are taking care of it.
And the fact that if you have a heart attack in a state office, we are going to come and save you.
All right. So the governor is very concerned about efficiencies. And I'm wondering what you have done, what kind of cost-cutting measures you have implemented since... This is not a new gap, not to be too braggy about it, but... Oh, be braggy. This is the moment.
Over the past 5 years, right? So those are my budgets. I've had five budgets. Our budgets over 5 years have increased 0.48%.
That's not a lot.
That's a total in 5 years. That's not each year. Oh. Each year, we're talking about a 0.096% increase. As we've seen our health insurance costs go up, as we've seen our employee costs go up, we've been able to find savings and drive savings elsewhere in the city. We've become more effective. We've become more efficient. We have this really great lean office that was recognized by the state for the work that we're doing. Things like we came up with a new process. It cut 12,000 miles, right, of transportation going back and forth and back and forth among all of our different... Right, we eliminated that. We've eliminated the amount of time it takes for certain processes. We are doing really exciting things.
All right,
but we can't balance our budget without the 12.5.
No. Okay. Yeah. So, with the belt tightening that the state is inevitably going to have to do, the governor's 30-day budget amendments are coming out this week, at the latest by Thursday. So, what if you don't get it in the 30-day budget amendments and the legislature can't come up with the money because they have other priorities that they want to
We're talking about devastating impacts. We're talking about police. We're talking about fire. We're talking about eliminating an award-winning summer youth employment program. I was just at the U.S. Conference of Mayors where we received a grant for some innovative work that we're doing with our summer youth employment program with the children of individuals who are incarcerated or refugees who have been, traumatized. So we are talking about devastating okay. cuts.
For my listeners to understand, if a government building is on a piece of taxable land, that means government is not taxable, so they don't have to pay any taxes. And so Kathy Sheehan over here doesn't get that revenue. All right. Albany Business Review says that you see the new $750 million Wadsworth Health Labs as an opportunity to talk about this issue.
Yes. I mean, we have a pilot payment that we receive for the Empire State Plaza that people in other cities across the state have to recognize. When you come to this Capitol and you see that huge plaza and the amazing buildings that are on it.
That IBM isn't on it.
And it used to be home to 10,000 people. There was a neighborhood there. It wasn't as if there was a big empty piece of property in the city. 10,000 people displaced, 90 acres. We have another piece of property that is out on the western edge of the city that was going to be open up for private development. IBM could move there. But now we're going to have the state build a lab. And I want to say to the governor, I agree 100% with his decision.
You build that lab.
Build that lab. You know, you have to manage to your property. I look at the property that we own, and we have to be good stewards of that. So I 100% support that decision. We will be seeking a pilot payment for that campus. It never came to fruition that it was opened up for private development. I understand why. We've got to find a way that we can work together.
So Wadsworth is a mixed blessing. Really, it's going to be good. I mean, if it all comes to pass, it'll be good for the economic situation here in Albany. But again, it takes taxable land off the table.
Well, what it will do is it will be good for the region. And that's the other piece that people need to understand. Most of the people that come and work in these buildings don't live in the city. So they're not generating property tax. And they're walking into buildings that aren't paying property taxes. The top 10 employers in Albany, New York are... New York State, right? Albany Medical Center, St. Peter's Hospital, Memorial Hospital.
What do they all have in common?
The Center for Disability Services, right? They are all non-taxable. And so, yes, people are coming into this city and they're working, but they're working in buildings that are generating no property tax.
Mayor, have you ever, I'm sure that you've thought about perhaps, implementing a nonprofit tax or something?
We can't. And I will say, shout out to Albany Medical Center. They have given us $500,000 a year voluntarily, year after year, when they can afford it. When they can afford it, which I understand. So we work with our not-for-profits, and we understand that there are economic benefits to having them here in the city.
What about a county-city sales tax issue?
So we get a portion of the sales tax, but it's shared based on our nighttime population, not our daytime population. Mm. So whether somebody spends a dollar in the city of Albany or just across the line in Guilderland, where the mall is, it doesn't matter because we get the same portion of that dollar.
So you've explored all of this. And here you are 5 years later asking for the same $12.5 million. That's got to get old.
It does get old because I can't talk about the other issues that I want to talk about, right? I'd love to talk about infrastructure. I'd love to be able to talk about cannabis and the legalization of cannabis. I'd love to be able to talk about you know, what we could be doing for our seniors. There are lots of things I'd like to be talking about, but we have to come and talk about this $12.5 million every year. And as I said, if it weren't structural, I'd be asking for more. And I'm not.
It's always 12.5.
It's been 12.5.
All right.
Yes.
We have a few minutes, so I am going to ask you about cannabis.
Sure.
All right. So, you know, there are a bunch of concerns over law enforcement, the message it sends to young people. What do you think about legalizing recreational marijuana?
So, first of all, I support it. Secondly, I have asked the New York Conference of Mayors to convene a meeting, which is going to happen on February 27th, focused on mayors and on the issues that we can expect to see at the municipal level. There are other states that have legalized marijuana. We need to learn from the unintended consequences of those implementations. And so we're going to pull together some of the best minds that we can to talk about the issues that matter to mayors, not to say that the issues around addiction and around young people aren't important, but I'm really want to be focused on what does it mean for our zoning? What does it mean from a revenue standpoint? You know, right now the proposal is none of the revenue would come to the municipalities, but we would have to train our police officers.
Enforcement is a huge deal.
You know, the amount of cash that is, and for me, the other critically important thing, the social justice issues. You know, I believe in the legalization of marijuana because we have been putting far too many disproportionately black and brown people in jail over something that people do, you know, people who look like me do all the time, right? But if we don't provide for true opportunities within those communities to benefit from legalization, I'm concerned about black market. I'm concerned about, you know, the illicit trade, you know, undermining what it is that we're trying to achieve by legalization.
One last quick question. The marijuana debate comes on the heels of a year that saw 15 homicides in Albany, which is high for the city. Is that going to be part of your thought process as
yes,
you debate?
Yes, because
this?
Most of the violence in our city is in some ways connected to the illicit drug trade. And so this is a really, it's interconnected. It's a really important issue.
We've been speaking with Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, who is at the budget today to testify before lawmakers at the Joint Legislative Budget hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
So on Wednesday, the governor's counsel, Alfonso David, testified before state lawmakers about Governor Cuomo's cannabis proposal. During his testimony, he stated that since Washington, D.C. and 10 states, including Vermont and Massachusetts, have legalized it, quote, taking no action and maintaining the status quo is simply no longer sustainable. But there are groups that remain firmly against legalization, and today we speak with one of them, the New York State PTA. Kyle Belikopitsky is the executive director of the group. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Susan. Thanks for having us on the show.
What is the PTA's position on legalizing cannabis?
Well, I think we're really adamantly opposed. This has actually been a PTA position since 1982, if you can imagine. So this position has been renewed every 7 years by our membership. The last time it was renewed, it was in 2012. It's going to be up again for resolution renewal this coming November.
And what is the exact question that you ask? Is it just should cannabis be legalized, or is it more complicated?
Yeah, there's a large resolution process where we have data, and our resolutions team puts together the kind of pros and cons, and all of our members vote on that.
And the last time they voted on it, what was the percentage?
It was a no, and I apologize, I don't have that figure for you, but it was an overwhelming no.
All right.
And our continuing, our new board, our legislative committee, our resolutions committee still continue to have that position.
And the reason why?
This is a harmful proposal for children. What we see in Colorado and D.C. and other states recently, myself in Massachusetts, is that unfortunately, you know, when legalization happens, you know, underage children, you know, get their hands on marijuana in higher numbers. I was recently at a Massachusetts ski mountain with my son, who's 9. The children in front of us were 15 years old on the ski lift. Smoking marijuana. Being the mom that I am, I got off the ski lift. I went over. I yelled at them. I made them call their parents. So their parents knew. They weren't very happy with me.
Don't mess with Kyle, man.
But then, you know, my son, who is 9, is saying, you know, mommy, what's that smell? What's that smell?
Sure.
So I have a conversation with him. We already have those conversations with our children about drug use, et cetera.
So you think, I mean, clearly you're making the connection between Massachusetts legalizing cannabis and those kids on the ski lift in front of you smoking. They could have been smoking before it was legal.
Absolutely. But what we do see is that, you know, when Colorado's has the best information, the youth rates rise substantially. In addition to that, I mean, the Miracle Medical Association, our New York State Medical Society, are all saying this is harmful for even adults to begin smoking marijuana. You know, there are real problems with two things that do need to be solved. The medical marijuana system. There's a lot of problems with the system, with access and equity and the cost.
That's a system you support.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we continue to support New York State's medical marijuana program. We think that that should be reviewed. We think that the experts that work on that program should look at whether or not there should be other diseases that are included in that program. And on top of that, we have serious criminal justice issues that need to be solved because we have systemic problems. And really, it's abhorrent that we have disproportional arrests and jailing
What we're going to do is take a quick break, Kyle. We'll be right back to talk a little bit more about the criminal justice issue. We're talking with Kyle Bella-Kapitsky. She is the executive director of New York State PTA about cannabis legalization. We'll be right back.
Capital Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.
We've been talking a lot about legalizing cannabis in New York. Over the last, I would say, 2 weeks, there has been a louder and louder outcry from critics, including groups like the Sheriff's Association and the PTA. And today we have the executive director of the PTA on the show with us, Kyle Bella-Kapitsky. And we were talking about some things. You know, a lot of people say, well, one of the reasons why we want to do this is because of the disparate justice that has been meted out over the criminalization of marijuana, and this would take care of some of those social justice issues. And you agree.
Absolutely. We have to fix that system. I think the problem is some of the preliminary data we're seeing out of Colorado, and I actually just pulled it up in front of me, is that, you know, according to the Colorado Department of Public Safety, since legalization, and this was a report that they have from 2018 on their website, since legalization in Colorado, the arrest rates for African-American men in particular has actually continued to double that of Caucasians.
In Colorado.
And then,
why?
You know, again, this is a systemic problem we have to fix. According to the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice, African-Americans are twice as likely to be arrested for marijuana still in Colorado and in Washington, both states that have already legalized recreational marijuana.
Is it young people that are being arrested?
It's often younger people.
All right. So let me see.
So we have to fix this. This is a huge issue. issue. I mean, you know, we know that we have a significant criminal justice issues, you know, about but very not, high rates of arresting, you know, young, especially young African-American and Hispanic males.
So, but you are not swayed by the social justice argument that, you know, hey, neighborhoods that have been decimated by the criminalization of pot could see reparations in the form of, say, revenue from the sale of cannabis.
When I think what we saw, well, see also in Colorado, hold on, I'm just going to, I wanted to bring all our, some of our data with us.
Kyle is Googling fiercely.
I have a whole fact sheet in front of me, okay. Susan, so I can be accurate. Uh-huh. And the same thing, you know, the problem is that if the arrest rates actually went down, I think that would be a valid argument. What we see from Colorado, from Washington, is that that is not the case. Those arrest rates are actually getting higher. I think we actually have, you know, we have to look at things, and we talked about these things in some of our materials, real sentencing guidelines, real training, real decriminalization. That's important, and we have to look at those things. I think that's a bigger conversation, and I think it's not just marijuana, but it's also other low-level drug offenses.
Well, you know what? One of the things that does resonate, and I think with a lot of people, is that, you know, young people are already navigating sort of a landmine of issues, yeah, from vaping and cigarettes and opioids. You know, why add cannabis to the list of harmful drugs that they're going to be dealing with?
Is, yeah.
You know, that's a,
yeah, absolutely, and that's
legitimate argument.
One of our other positions, you know, right now, as it stands, 1 in 5 high school students is vaping in our schools. 1 in 5. And so what we already know from vaping is that they're already targeting, you know, children and youth. And where we are happy to see the governor's proposal on Tobacco 21 and some, yeah, of the targeting to try to take away the flavored e-cigarette liquids and things like that, they're going to be vaping marijuana. So this is just going to expound on the problem that we already have. The governor and the legislature have done a fantastic job trying to reduce youth vaping, trying to reduce youth alcohol use, trying to really combat substance use disorders and the heroin and opioid epidemic that we're having. Why are we going to add to that?
So there are some reasons why they want to add to that. Again, what Alphonso David said yesterday at the taxation hearing is we are going to be left behind as a state in terms of revenue. I'm just repeating
I understand what
he said. And we don't have a choice that the status quo is not something that we can deal with.
Yeah, and one of your colleagues at a press conference I was at recently asked me that. And I said, well, my son's health and safety and welfare is worth more than $300 million. Like all of our children, safe and healthy and welfare. This is going to increase child use of marijuana.
Even though the legalization is
absolutely
supposed to be above, I can't remember what it is, 21.
Yes, we see 600,000 of our kids right now are smoking tobacco. Across the country. I mean, we have
even though
serious,
that's illegal,
exactly,
too.
We have a serious epidemic with youth use of tobacco and alcohol now.
Another issue is enforcement. I mean, just that is about enforcement, but yeah, also on the road. There's no cannabis equivalent to a breathalyzer. If legalization does happen, Kyle, okay, and I'm not saying that it is, but if it does, because a lot of people are pushing for this.
I absolutely hear that.
What kind of protections would you like to see included in the bill?
I think we need a bigger conversation. You know, the first thing is to get this out of budget negotiations. This shouldn't be a part of the budget. We need a longer conversation about how, if New York is going to do this again, and we don't support that.
And both Speaker Hastie and Majority Leader Stuart Cousins have said this should be out of the budget.
Yeah, and we would agree with them. That's not the place to do this. I think we need a real conversation about how we're going to try to, one, continue to support substance use disorders and those that may be affiliated with addiction, how we're going to try to, you know, really reduce or lessen the impact on children, how we're going to train. I just had a conversation with the Chiefs Association, Police of Chiefs Association, and, you know, they have to retrain all of their drug dogs because right now all the drug dogs will hit on marijuana. So none of those drug dogs across the state would then be useful to them as police agencies. How are we going to have what's called DREs? These are drug enforcement officers that are trained by police departments to identify drug driving.
That's going to cost a lot of money to educate a whole new kind of enforcement officer.
Absolutely. And if we're going to do this again, which we don't support, but if New York State's going to do this, it has to be thoughtful. This can't be rushed. All of the other states have done this by referendum. New Jersey, you know, declined to do this by legislation because this was such an important issue that they put it to the voters. Looking at
don't have that. We don't have initiative and referendum.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the only way we can do it, so, is by the legislature acting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree. I think speaking with a lot of legislators, they too are saying the same things. There's a lot of implementation challenges to this. There's a lot of criminal justice, changing of thoughts and minds on this. That really has to go, especially with some of the enforcement methods. You know, off the top of my head, what do we think about bus drivers? You know, marijuana, as we know, stays in your, test it for positive marijuana for a long time, even after you are sober.
Good point.
What are we going to do about our bus drivers and their, random drug tests and things like this that we're doing now?
At the same time, you think about alcohol, okay? Mm-hmm. People, that kind of, banning alcohol did not work.
No.
And, people are going to drink. So why not just treat this the way we treat alcohol?
And I think I hear that argument. And again, we had when alcohol, obviously, we have a lot of underage children using alcohol and we have a lot of underage children using tobacco. Why are we just going to add to the pot? Why are we going to give them one more avenue to unfortunately make a poor choice? I'm a mom. I know lots of us are parents and have children in our lives. We have to figure this out first for them.
Kyle Bela-Kapitsky is the executive director of the New York State PTA, and she is not a fan of the legalization of cannabis. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Susan, thanks for having us on.
And I want to thank you for joining us for the Capitol Press Room. Our producer has been Tim Williams.
Howdy.
And our engineer, Neil Winchell. I'm Susan Arbetter, and you've been listening to the Capitol Press Room.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.